side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our way if we keep on the sunny side of life.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Export Finance Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome back Richard to join us along with Simon and Gabby. Welcome everyone. Today's conversation is on distribution. It's obviously a topic close to everyone's hearts. Just to kick off, if everyone would like to say, just talk through the general trends that you're seeing within distribution at the moment. Who'd like to take that first?
You're looking at me, Gabby.
Okay, whatever.
Okay. I guess TD has a unique position in that we are on the end of that distribution because TD is an investor in the paper. So the trends, I guess, we're seeing is that, particularly in US dollars, there would appear to be an increased desire from banks to look at distribution more than perhaps they had been doing over the more recent years. So I think banks are generally distributing more than they used to, correct?
Completely agree. Yeah, I would say there's more of it. That's the overriding trend. More and more people have realised that distribution is key to getting the KPIs for the product right. And it's if 10 years ago it was all about grabbing assets and keeping them, now it's about lead arranging. Keep some if you can, and I guess we'll get onto this, but I do think having a mixed strategy of hold some and sell some is the right way to go. But there's just more of every sort of distribution going on in the market at the moment. All currencies, all types of ECAs, all sorts of underlying risk, and I think that's healthy.
Okay.
Yeah. From HSBC's perspective as well, completely agree with what both the Simons have just said. It's integral to the business model at the moment. We have to be showing the velocity on the book, getting assets out the door, and there are a range of reasons behind that. Regulatory, there's commercial and economic reasons. It makes a lot of sense for us to distribute as well. And ultimately, it's a way of keeping competitive as well. So, exactly as Simon said, from 10 years ago, we would take book and hold every single asset that we could get our hands on. As it stands at the moment, we will consider a range of options to distribute and maximise the potential of each deal that we're looking at.
I also don't think you should think that distribution is a new thing either. I know what Richard's just said about taking and holding every asset, which was possibly true, possibly an overemphasis, but there certainly have been banks for the last 10, 15 years who've adopted a distribution approach. So I think you've had half the market, or maybe slightly more than half the market, holding assets historically under Basel I in particular, because you had low capital usage by booking ECA assets. But I think there's also been a lot of banks who had a distribution model. We won't name names right now, but certainly one of my old institutions, we started looking at distribution 15 years ago. We liked the asset, but we found we could do more and have better metrics inside the bank, as Simon Sayer just said. And intuitively, I think it makes sense as well. And someone mentioned common sense, and I think common sense is part of it. You know, just to book and hold every asset in today's environment isn't going to work anymore.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I used to work for an organisation that had distribution as part of its DNA.
Yeah.
And if it was actually quite interesting in that if you were unable to distribute the asset because you had structured it incorrectly or priced it incorrectly, that was deemed to be a poor asset. So you were having to mark to market those assets and be able to distribute it would be a way of evidencing that you've been productive in the role of providing good quality assets to the bank.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of that sort of trend curve, from, well, I guess let's say a mixture of some just booking and holding 10 years ago, some to distributing. Now it's more of a mixed bag. Is that continuing? Is it going to be even more distribution, or do you think there's a kind of critical point where actually you need to hold on to some stuff still?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, and this is with my BBA hat on, mm-hmm. Where it's covering both export finance and trade, and we were talking about it earlier. There's a whole array of different banks with different business models. So you'll have banks who are there, particularly the retail stroke commercial banks, who would see booking and holding assets as a core competency. And it's a KPI for them in terms of the annuity income associated with that asset. Mm. There's those banks who are much more wholesale stroke investment banks. You know, they would see distribution as being a key component in terms of their business model, where it's servicing the client and then becoming a true financial intermediary. The challenge, I think, for banks at the moment is where they try and do a mix and match between the two. And I think that is a little confusing for both internally and externally. I think it's difficult for a bank to be both on one asset, booking and holding, and then on another, selling. And I think we are in a transition phase within the market. And I think in the next 2 or 3 years, I think we'll settle in one form or another.
I think regulation has a bit to play in that as well. And it's not only the models of the banks, but the banks on a global basis are also in different regulatory environments. So, you know, the Japanese banks have their regulation, the US banks have their regulation, the European banks have theirs. And they all adapt and adopt to their regulation in slightly different ways. So I think we are moving more towards, generically, a more distribution. Even for the banks that have always held historically, distribution is going to be the way forward because of regulation in particular. But also, when we talk about distribution, there's external distribution, which is what people immediately think of, but there's a lot of internal distribution going. So in-house covered bond programs, you know, the French banks, everyone knows that the three big French banks have very sizable cover bond programs. Now, is that distribution or is that not distribution? You know,
it's for funding.
It's funding. And again, what is distribution? You can distribute the risk, you can distribute the balance sheet cost, you can distribute the funding. You know, there are lots of different forms of distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, so in terms of if there is this move to, you know, to sell off more or whatever, does that mean that what constitute, you know, what types of assets, you know, are there some assets that are easier to sort of to distribute, others that are more difficult, and then I guess because of that will become less applicable for export finance, say?
Yeah, for sure there are some assets that are easier to distribute. I think over the last few years there's been a huge flight to quality, actually. I think people really want to have the top-rated ECA-covered assets, so the AAAs, to the extent there are any left, there's two or three, I think, maybe.
And also there's guarantees, Simon.
And guarantors rather than insurers. 100% rather than 95% if possible. I think that's starting to change a little bit, and I think people are starting to realise that you've only got one balance sheet, and if you're going to use that balance sheet, you need to have a mix of better yielding assets as well as lower yielding assets. And just as a general comment, this is a low risk, low return business, and if you have a balance sheet that is uniquely low risk, low return, you're not going to be getting a great return on your balance sheet. So I think that, you know, immediately post-crisis, huge flight to quality. They were the easiest assets to sell down. The weaker-rated ECAs were less easy. Not, still relatively easy. These are still good assets. But I think increasingly people are realising that having some yield as well is important. And some of those weaker-rated ECAs or PRI-covered transactions make your overall blended portfolio look a little bit more attractive.
Okay, and but then so that's obviously related to the ECA, and then how about sort of sectorally or yeah. geographically? Does that kind of come into play as well?
Well, from our perspective at HSBC, we look at each individual transaction and look at what the dynamic is for that specific scenario. So I wouldn't say this idea that we're selling off, I don't really see it as that in my mind at the moment. It's about how do we make the most out of that individual deal and how does it fit into our portfolio. So you know, whether that's through primary syndication, secondary syndication into the bank market, or working from the outset to look at a capital market solution, you know, and we will put that apply that across industries, different sectors, different countries. Now, clearly, the depth of a particular country, if you're looking at some of the more riskier markets, maybe it will be more challenging to look at a capital market solution at that point in time. It will be probably easier to go straight into the secondary market with banks that have a familiarity with the ECA product. But you know, it will very much be a case-by-case scenario from our perspective, rather than a general trend across our whole portfolio or our whole business.
Okay, and so yeah, so you mentioned in terms of the importance of either capital markets versus, you know, I guess the bank syndication market or bank distribution. Is that sort of that blend between capital markets and banking sort of traditional banks sort of taking is that changing at all, or is that?
I think it is, but it's probably slower than we would have liked. I still think we're doing a majority of our distribution out into the bank market through the secondary sales. But I think in time we will move more into the capital markets, and I think that's just it will be the familiarity with the product, using the schemes that are available from the export credit agencies, and getting the volumes through the system. I think that's the issue that we're facing at the moment. You know, these deals take a very long time to put together, particularly when you're going into the more challenging markets. And the issue that we're facing is that if you're going to go with the capital market solution at the outset of the deal, it can take a very long time to put a transaction together and move it out into the capital markets. Whereas at least, you know, with the bank, with the secondary sales into the banking market, you know that those banks understand that it is going to take a long time for this deal to reach fruition.
Yeah, but it's interesting that, because, you know, I used to work somewhere where we sold everything. Mm. And there was a point in time where we had a very large portfolio and we just wanted to sell. And we were selling that at, you know, tickets at $1 billion at the time. Sometimes it were to banks, sometimes to non-banks. And, the ability, when you've got a portfolio of assets, you don't have to be just selling your new stuff. You could be churning your portfolio by selling existing that creates capacity to do new. And I would say that the fixed income market have moved on from looking at it as a capital markets quotation issuance. You know, a lot of fixed income investors were then saying, oh, I'll take this asset as a loan. Mm. So they are quite happy to get somebody else to do the structuring and arranging and then book it as a loan, not having it to be rated. So, you know, there's huge amounts of liquidity out there in the non-bank market who are hungry in today's environment for high quality, long dated assets.
Mm. I completely agree with that. Huge demand in non-banks. However, I think the reason it hasn't moved as quickly as we might have anticipated 2 or 3 years ago, when we all agreed that capital markets were the future of the business, is that the path of least resistance is still distribution into the bank market. Mm-hmm. You know, banks do this for a living, and to the extent there's still liquidity in the bank market, that's going to suck up deals first, because it's just the easiest way to go. Not necessarily the best price. And we've got to remember, when you sell deals down, banks usually want some fees on transactions if they're buying in either primary or secondary too, which institutional investors don't always want to receive. So I think one of the things that's slowed the pace of change down is the fact there is just so much liquidity left still in the bank market to do this, and that is just the path of least resistance.
Post-crisis liquidity did return, 13, 14, 15, liquidity returned. And the capital, there are several issues. Firstly, the distribution market for ECA assets
is incredibly fragmented, because you've got different guarantee and insurance schemes across different countries that house ECAs. You've also got, in some countries they do direct lending, in some countries they provide liquidity, they provide funding via, you know, SEK and FEC, etc. You've got FanBrief operating for the a range of ECAs. In addition to Euler Hermes, you've got COFAS have now got access to SPHIL, which works in euros very, very effectively. And you've got the bank market that is there in various currencies. You've got new investors coming in, pockets of investors around the world, like the Japanese regional banks came in, the US regional banks came in. So the whole distribution is very fragmented. So you haven't got, it's very difficult to get an ECA asset class. And the other thing that's compounded capital markets sort of slowing down a little bit is, of course, US Essen's been shut for effectively 12 months. It's going to be shut for possibly another 6 months. Who knows? 6 months? 12 months? I don't know. Who knows? And, of course, the majority of capital markets as a product has been driven around the US Exim product. And that achieved quite some size. I mean, about 25, 26 billion, I think, has been issued between 2009 and this year.
Mm. Still mainly aviation, though, right?
So, it's mainly aviation. Mm. But the pricing, I think, how we look at it is the pricing of the capital markets drives the bank pricing, because if you've got bank investors who want that US Exim asset, they will raise their price up until the threshold price only of the capital markets if they want to keep it out the capital markets. So let's say, for argument's sake, 50 basis points, just very arbitrarily, 50 basis points is the price of issuing a US Exim bond with a typical 6-year average life tenor. If there's a banking market, the banking market will price it around that level to keep it in the bank market. If there's no appetite, then the capital market deal will get done.
Yeah, which is madness. It's complete madness. I remember when we were selling assets in the primary basis, we would say to ourselves, what is the CDS pricing for that sovereign? What is the CDS pricing for that bank? You know, and we use the CDS pricing for that bank as a kind of litmus test as what they're...
It's not a great test, though, is it?
No, but it's not a bad test.
Okay? It's a test.
It's a test, okay, of what their funding costs would be. Oh. And we would say to ourselves, if I'm selling this asset to this particular bank, the price that would be the kind of benchmark price will be the combination of the two. Guess what? Some of these banks would take that asset at lower than their CDS price. Mm. And we would say, hey, why would you do that? It's great for the borrower because they got pricing. Yeah.
But banks aren't joined up.
They're not. And when you've got banks who...
It's a headline, right? Yeah.
Who are willing to do that, then the issue about this asset, making it an asset class, and why there isn't a lot of liquidity going on into the capital markets, is because of the point you just made, Simon, that a lot of banks are pricing this at what I consider to be below par. And so long as there's that appetite of banks to come in and book these assets at you know, too fine a margin for whatever reason,
Well, is that appetite still there?
Yeah.
And what are the reasons?
Well, the capital markets.
Well, I don't know about the reasons.
So on the banks, I mean.
On the bank side,
yeah.
Well, banks do things for different reasons, and the one major reason banks do things is for clients. And sometimes, because it's a client, they will do things they wouldn't normally do. I mean, there are some huge borrowers out there who provide a lot of wallet to banks. I mean, I can think of one particular company that we probably all lent to in the past, where we do things at a below market price because of the substantial wallet they provide in other areas.
Mm. Yeah, well, I completely agree with that. Banks do things for clients, but there's also
a
bunch of banks out there who are just buying the asset.
Yep. Yeah,
and those banks that you described who are pricing the asset off where they think the threshold is on the capital markets issuance, I think that only really applies to aircraft.
Yes.
And US Exim.
Yes, no, it does.
And once you move away from that,
I think
that link is not so strong.
Yeah, and when you say move away from it, that is now the entire market, right?
Yeah, that's true.
When you've moved away from it.
And Europe, But this is what's so interesting about the market at the moment, because here we are talking about distribution and it's essential to sell down, and yet there are still banks who want to buy this just for the asset class, mm-hmm. just because of the asset, not because of a client relationship, no. not because they feel it's something they have to do, but because they want
that.
The asset.
But they're doing that. Take the, I mean, one big investor base that
I've used in my previous organisations right from the early 2000s was the German Landesbanks. The German Landesbanks generically had a lot of liquidity to use up. Yeah, they had these family programs. It's driven by the investor. Okay, thinking the investment bank as opposed to the commercial bank, their investors need product, so they were driven to provide product for their investors.
Yeah,
that's why Goldman Sachs sort of really drove the bond market for US exit. It wasn't because they were an ECA bank. Everyone knows they're not an ECA bank. They had investor requirement. They had investors saying, we want highly rated sovereign paper that yields more than US treasuries.
That was a market anomaly that was extraordinary, actually. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Landesbanks were allowed to issue bonds with a federal guarantee up to about 2005. They all rushed out, issued... Mm-hmm. Issued into the market, they were long liabilities, suddenly needed assets and needed to fill that position very, very quickly. And so there was you're absolutely right, it was almost a feeding frenzy into the German market of deals being sold.
Yeah, but those anomalies do come and go. I mean, what I'm pointing out is that you get distribution into those pockets of liquidity that happen to appear, and they may appear for a 5-6 years, they may appear for 2 years. The Japanese market.
Or six months.
Yeah. Look at the Japanese regionals. There were 13 Japanese regional banks in one ECA project financing in Vietnam a couple of years ago. 13 Japanese regionals. Unbelievable.
Any pockets of liquidity that are current? Yeah,
pension funds, life insurance companies. They've
always been there. Yeah.
They're always there. They've got.
That's an anomaly, or that's
no.
Well, no, is there liquidity in that market? Undoubtedly. And they I remember when we used to distribute to them, they would say, look, you know, we need this bigger and we need this longer. You know, have you got any 30-year, 40-year assets? Mm-hmm. You know, we could, you know, quadruple the amount of capacity here. The challenge was that the bank market was always underpricing, in my opinion, what the fixed income market were looking for. And I go back to this point that there are the behaviour of banks as to why they do what they do on the ECA is hard to work out as to the rationale. And I do hear, Simon, when you say about there's relationship reasons that, you know, a bank needs to be in with a particular client. But I have to admit, I do question that, because I do think that particularly with an export credit facility, how many borrowers will say to a bank, thank you for coming in on this transaction, which is wrapped by an export credit. I'm going to give you an M&A transaction. I'm going to give you this ancillary business. I think that's a very low percentage of the total business.
I think it's almost the reverse in most occasions that the ECA is seen as the ancillary to other things.
Less so today, and you know, I think it's all actually incumbent on us just to reposition this a little bit. And we've been trying to do this with clients over the last 2 or 3 years, and we've said, look, yes, this is ECA guaranteed, but this is still a provision of balance sheet.
Yeah.
It's still a provision of liquidity that we've got to fund. And that uses up our ratios, our KPIs. So, yes, client, this is ECA guaranteed, but actually we were never worried about your risk anyway. This isn't a risk issue. This is about funding and balance sheet that we're making available. Yeah. And I think that is the repositioning that is still very much in flux. Yeah.
And do you get a lot of ancillary business as a result of that?
We certainly get some, and we've been successful in positioning this to clients as saying, you know, we're providing liquidity through these ECA-covered facilities, and therefore we'd like to do your bond business or your derivative business as well. Other clients just don't get that. And so, hang on, you're right. But we're in a period of flux.
Depends on the sophistication of the client.
Yeah, exactly. It depends on who you're speaking to and their where they are in terms of their maturity and understanding of the markets. But yeah, I think the the systems internally within the banks now are set up to drive that process. And I think we're aligned with where Deutsche are on this, that, you know, it's certainly not seen as an ancillary product within the bank. And, you know, that's the message that we're trying to get out to the client base.
Yeah. And, yeah. Well, and sticking on that client issue as well, both in terms of buyers and in terms of exporters as well, how has the attitude to distribution compared to book and hold sort of changed, or is it changing? Are there some clients that are still like, well, wait a minute, sort of, where's your skin in the game? Is that still coming on, or has that conversation moved on?
So really interesting, and for the same reasons that clients want to see their banks commit liquidity to them, some clients are deeply uncomfortable if you say, actually, we're going to sell most of this asset into the market. And we still have clients which are demanding very large tickets on transactions. You know, your entry ticket for our deal is $250 million, and we expect you to hold that. And that's a very, very painful sort of ticket size for banks to hold on to and commit to hold on to, particularly if you want to manage a portfolio properly. Other clients saying, actually, if you underwrite that and take that in primary, then we don't really mind what you do with it after that.
And especially if you've retained, say, the agency role on the transaction, so that we're dealing with you on an ongoing basis, that certainly seems to take the edge off it from their perspective. But we've heard some horror stories, and you know, some of the African governments we've spoken to, where they've moved, had assets moved off completely onto other institutions, and then being, you know, pinned down for massive fees to do minor amendments. Yeah, you know, these kind of things are happening. So there are some, you know, case studies which show that, you know, borrowers will absolutely refuse now to allow any form of distribution, at least without their full consent.
Mm. And I guess sort of this move to a kind of more mixed portfolio, how has that changed staffing within export finance departments, if there are less assets to manage or more assets to distribute to more parties? There's probably two parts of that question. Is that?
I still think it's driven by the underlyings of where the market is in general at the moment. You know, where, you know, our volumes up or down. You know, clearly we're significantly off the peak that we saw, you know, 4 or 5 years ago in terms of volumes of business. But you know, clearly there is a change in dynamic. If we are going to distribute more, you know, the competition becomes more intense. It's not about your ability to provide balance sheet. And there are more players in that space. But the work, you know, what I will say is that the workload on a transaction, whether you're distributing it or whether you're holding it, is exactly the same. Ultimately, you're going to pass it off to another team to administer if you're holding. Even if you're out there just looking at full distribution, the workload's still exactly the same, if not more in some cases.
I think that question's an interesting question and is going to be a challenge for the market going forward, in that if you're a bank that have historically had its profitability predominantly based on the annuity income of your portfolio, and your size of your team, the shape of your team, the skill set of your team is based on booking and holding long-dated assets. Changing from that to a advise and distribute, where you will not have that annuity income anymore, and also the skill set that you need is a very different skill set when you're an advisor to someone who's going along saying, I've got cheap balance sheet. And I think when banks are trying to do both, and they find that their annuity income starts to reduce down and the profitability per headcount starts to change, then I think you're going to see a shedding of people, and I think there's going to be a slight change in the type of people who will still be active in this market.
Yeah. ECA teams at the big ECA banks across the world have had big middle and back offices because the product is a specialist product. You can't administer it inside a normal loans admin area. So it's those areas that could change. But the glad Gabby raised the skill set change was something I was going to mention. The one skill set I've noticed across the years is the skill set of being able to distribute, because historically, up until more recently, the distribution of these assets has come from within the team. So you've had, you know, the old-fashioned teams used to have people who could arrange export credits, and then gradually over a period of time that changed to more and more distribution skills coming into those teams, and so the skill set has changed remarkably over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, conceivably, could you have a situation where you have, okay, certain banks specialise in origination and distribution, and some almost act completely on the secondary market as clients, could you have clients for clients, sorry, clients for banks? So, you know, sort of the BNY Mellon style institution that actually look after export finance assets for a number of banks who have originated deals. Could that be a possibility rather than it being done in-house?
It's a reality already. I mean, I think there are banks who are already advisors and arrangers and use distribution as a marketing tool for clients. Because one of the things we haven't talked about is that the pricing for this asset is very opaque and very varied. And if you do a tendering of the asset at the beginning for a client where you tender out for the funding, the client gets transparency as to what the market clearing price is. And 9 times out of 10, and we're going back to this point about relationship, 9 times out of 10, the client will go for the cheapest. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, the skill set you need and the number of people that you need to do that is much smaller than the old style where, you know, we've all worked in large organisations which historically would have a book and hold and a large infrastructure of people who were managing those assets on a long-term basis. If more of these assets go into the fixed income market, the skill set and the bank teams doing ECA business, in my opinion, will be a much smaller but more highly skilled and more sought after, because the skill set you need as an advisor and arranger is very different from someone who's just, as I said earlier, putting balance sheet out the door at a low price.
Okay. Well, I think I'm going to wrap it up there, because I know that our next podcast, whenever that may be, is going to be focused more on the relationship with investors and the capital market. We can go into more detail on that. So I'd like to just say, gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very much, and see you next time.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us everywhere.